Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Hey, today Steve and I are going to be talking about a superhero group that nigh unto everyone on the planet has likely heard of, and either read one of their comics or seen them on the big screen or both at some point in their 59 years of existence. Of course, I'm talking about Earth's Mightiest Heroes, Marvel Comics Avengers, who made their very first appearance way back in 1963 in their self-titled comic, The Avengers No. 1. The roster would change and evolve over the years to include even multiple teams and combinations. But honestly, when it comes to the Avengers comics, I've only read a few volumes of the Avengers in 2004, and there's a whole lot between 1963 and then. For that reason, your man, dear listeners, for that chunk has got to be my friend and co-host Steve Sellers. So why don't you take it over from here, Steve?
Sure thing. And lo, there came a day unlike any other, when Earth's Mightiest Heroes stood united against a common threat. That classic quote was the beginning of a comic book legend. Where a lot of people discovered the Avengers with the MCU, with the 2000s comics, I discovered much earlier. There was a time when I lived and breathed the Avengers, and I picked up every book, even after they started branching out. But this also gives me a different perspective than a lot of people in the Avengers, because I knew what they were like before the films and the 2000s comics started really changing what the team fundamentally was. But we'll get into that once we start diving into the history of the Avengers. But Mike, I'm curious, what's your take on Earth's Mightiest Heroes?
Well, you know, I'm a fan of the Avengers. You know, I love Thor. We talked about that in our Thor episode. And Captain America and Hulk are another couple all-time favorites we talked about already. And while I admit to not being a big fan of Iron Man before the 2008 film when it first came out, I have come to really appreciate his place on the team as well. Wasp and Ant-Man have also become big favorites of mine since the MCU, but I rarely read the Avengers as a kid, and we're stuck to their solo titles with the characters. I mean, even what I read from the mid-2000s wasn't much. I guess that before the MCU, I mostly cared about a few individual characters, and my concern with them when I read the comics was really more about the big crossover event they were in, and the Avengers were typically just a part of a much larger group of heroes fighting together. That is very likely just me, though, as they've been very popular for decades. All I know is that when I think back on the Avengers, it's the animated shows and the MCU films that really brought me in, not the comics. Again, though, I haven't read nearly as much as you, so why don't you go ahead and dive right into the Avengers comics, Steve?
Sure. This is another case where we probably arrived at the same place from different directions, which I find interesting.
My own personal favorites, definitely.
My own personal favorites would probably include Captain America, Black Widow, the Black Panther, or at least the way that Stan Lee and Christopher Priest wrote him, Justice, the Richard Rider version of Nova, even though he was a secret Avenger for about 5 minutes, and the Hulk. But as you say, let's get into the comics. Now, the Fantastic Four were originally intended as a team book that was meant to compete with DC's Justice League title. However, the Avengers were the real Justice League rival book, as it basically started with throwing Marvel's biggest solo characters into a team. Movie fans will probably find some of the basics familiar and some things a little bit different. The comics also started the Avengers with Loki as the team's first major villain. However, the lineup was a bit different, as the founding Avengers were Thor, Iron Man, Henry Pym as Ant-Man, Janet Van Dyne as the Wasp, and the Hulk. Hulk and later Cap sidekick Rick Jones was around too, and he's considered an honorary Avenger for his part to help form the team. Now, Captain America came along later, and he would be considered an honorary founder of the team, though he wouldn't make his first modern appearance until four issues into the book. Hulk would eventually leave, but Cap and the remaining founders were the Avengers for about 12 issues total.
I certainly look at Cap as a founding member. Besides, he gets a pass on not actually being there because he was frozen in ice whilst being a war hero. If that doesn't earn a guy some slack, well, I got to question the standards being used. Besides, I've always viewed Cap as the ideals and the hearts of the Avengers. You know, it's conscience. In other words, it wasn't really the Avengers until he arrived, at least in my opinion. It totally makes sense that the Hulk would leave too, especially back then. In fact, it was really a miracle that they even got the Hulk involved at all. And I'm actually kind of curious how they did that. I didn't get the impression that anybody outside of Rick and Betty Ross could reason with the Hulk at all. I mean, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, Hulk was an odd fit, and you might wonder how the Hulk ended up becoming Avenger. And it's true that he didn't last long in the comics, but back in the Silver Age, Hulk hadn't been completely nailed down as a character yet, which is why you get so many different personalities in the modern age. At first, Hulk was gray and much like the Joe Fixit persona, more a surly brute with some intelligence rather than the green childlike Hulk that you see in a lot of his 70s appearances. And Hulk's personality changed quite a bit as Stan kept experimenting with him. At times, he was closer to Hulk with Banner's brain or more like the merged Hulk from the Peter David comics. Those were the usual versions of Hulk you'd see in those early Avengers appearances. And even then, he didn't get along too well with the Avengers. So Hulk ended up becoming the first Avengers to leave the team. And then Cap became the first replacement as well as an honorary founder.
Yeah, you know, it was the Peter David stuff that I remember from Hulk's solo title when I read it as a kid. I remember feeling like the Hulk really stepped it up a level in that run. I even bought the thicker, the cardstock cover with the raised art and logo for issue number 377. Mm-hmm. It was a prized possession of mine for a while, even though I thought making the Hulk's logo pink was a little weird. But more on point, that makes a lot of sense. Hulk's MO was fighting monsters and others who forced him into it, like General Ross and the army. He was a nomad, a wanderer, and teams just wouldn't and didn't fit him, sounds like.
No, not at all. Now, that's one of my favorite issues overall as well, the one you pointed out. And the Merged Hulk is one of my favorite versions of the Hulk. But one day, hopefully, we'll get to talk about him. But you're right. He's never been a huge team player. Anyway, one thing that I always loved about the classic Avengers from the early comics up until Disassembled is how seriously they took their rules and organization. The Avengers are the only superhero team I know that runs according to Robert's rules of order. But it was very much like that. I mean, the team was an elected chairman. There was always a procedural way that Avengers meetings were handled with motions and, you know, seconding motions and so forth. There was a full Avengers charter, including bylaws and other rules governing its members. That made the Avengers feel more like a realistic organization rather than just a club of people who just happen to work together from time to time.
Honestly, I think that's how it has to be. I mean, when you're talking about superheroes, you are inevitably talking about egos and strong opinions. And without parliamentary procedure and a set standard of governing rules and regulations, you're going to get stuff like what happens often with my favorite mega team, the Justice League. They often start out with the greatest of intentions, as I'm sure all who do such things do. But more often than not, the Justice League parts ways because some votes counted more or less than others, and they just completely disagreed on how things should be done. With as much as I love the Justice League, this is one area where the Avengers are just a flat-out better team.
Oh, absolutely. I think it gave the Avengers a unique flavor that other groups didn't have. The other thing that sets them apart is the soap opera, where there was always emotional drama under the superheroics, and that even applied to their villains as well. Now, one singular villain that I think needs some discussion around this point, because this character has played the Avengers in one form or another since almost the beginning, and that villain is Kang the Conqueror, a time traveler from the far future who comes back to the present to conquer it. Now, even though he hasn't yet appeared in any Avengers films, he did appear in Loki, I believe. Kang is generally considered to be the Avengers' arch foe. If he isn't, it's close between him and Ultron. He typically comes back time and again, no pun intended, to challenge the Avengers, with varying degrees of success. The other thing to note about Kang is that he's been a number of different characters over the years. Even in the Stan Jack stories, he appears twice in two different identities. Once as Kang, and then again as his future self, Immortus. Later writers like to tie those various different time-traveling characters and establish them that as the life of a single person. So Kang starts off as Ramatut, who was an Egyptian pharaoh who fought the Fantastic Four. Then he becomes the Scarlet Centurion, who gets mixed up with the Squadron Supreme in another timeline. And then he conquers the 40th century and becomes Kang. We would also see later that a teenage Kang was a member of the Young Avengers, calling himself Iron Lad. Kang is a pretty complex character who leads a pretty complicated life, and sometimes his different selves will even fight each other. But when he's Kang, he's first and foremost a sworn enemy of the Avengers, and he's been involved in many of their most memorable stories.
You know, I'm guessing by your description there, I have to wonder if there isn't some kind of time ripple thing going on there with Kang. Like maybe there were a couple of events in Kang's time travel history where changes were made that rippled through his past and his future to change his present. Either that, or I want to say there's some kind of reincarnation thing happening there. But either way, that lifespan stretches across thousands and thousands of years. I mean, am I even close here?
Well, keep in mind that Marvel mostly operates on a multiverse approach to its time travel. Still, you're right in the sense that Kang's existence has caused a lot of branching pathways that wouldn't otherwise have happened. In fact, there's a group of alternate Kangs that propped up at one point, and they called themselves the Council of Cross-Time Kangs. But the regular Kang's lifespan probably is much longer than a normal human's. I mean, Immortus was granted longevity by his masters, the Timekeepers. But even before that, I think Kang probably had an extended lifespan because of far future medical technology. And maybe his suit also has a life support system. But to get back to the team, the first big roster shift came when the original founders all left, and you were left with Cap and his kooky quartet. We talked about that in the Cap episode. The new Avengers included characters most people would recognize, Hawkeye, the Scarlet Witch, and Quicksilver. But there was also the book's first big creative team shift as Jack Kirby stepped aside to make way for Don Heck. Those stories were very different, relying more on the conflict within the group and Cap finding ways to improve their teamwork. Their teamwork was usually essential to winning their encounters, and I think it shows how essential Cap is to the functioning of the Avengers. I honestly think Cap can make a great Avengers team out of almost anybody. But if you don't have him, good luck trying to build a working team. We've seen more than once that Cap can build a good team out of some of the weirdest lineups imaginable.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned this earlier, but I mean, Captain America is one of those guys that really knows his stuff, not just team and solo tactics, but also how to lead properly. He's a good teacher with the perfect balance of support and firmness. That alone would make a great leader, but I think that Cap is essential to a working Avengers team as he is the embodiment of the spirit of the Avengers. That's kind of why I always liked that the first Cap movie was called The First Avenger. You know, like he is the standard of morality and courage others measure themselves by. They do this because he does what is right and leads from the front line to battle by example, and that makes a really great and easy to follow leader. I can't help but think of the conversation between William Wallace and Robert the Bruce in Braveheart, where William says that the Bruce's title gives him the right to the throne of Scotland, but people don't follow titles, they follow courage.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Cap's courage and optimism inspires a lot of loyalty, but the roster wasn't the only thing that changed. I mean, The first major creative team change on Avengers was when Stan left the book, I mean, handing the reins to Roy Thomas. Even to this day, Roy Thomas is beloved by many Avengers fans as one of the best writers ever on the book. And while I don't think I'd personally necessarily agree with that, I don't think there's any question that he belongs on a best of list. He brought several memorable Avengers onto the team, including Hercules, the Black Panther, the Black Widow. He created the Vision, who is one of the huge mainstay characters and a key member of the group. And he created Dane Whitman, the third Black Knight, and the nephew of the second one. He did some interesting things with those characters, too. Roy Thomas also wrote one of my favorite versions of Hercules, including a story where Herc managed to fight off the Submariner by himself. And then you have Even an Android Can Cry, which is Vision's debut story. And it's a great single-issue tale that establishes a who Vision is as a character. Ultron is the main villain in that one, and it's great. Thomas is also known for one of the most iconic Avengers stories, the Kree Skrull War. It's partly as beloved as it is because it was drawn by the late, great Neil Adams, RIP, and his issues are outstanding. But the idea of the Avengers having to deal with two alien empires fighting over the Earth and having to fight them both off was epic at that time. You got good moments here and there, too, with Henry Pym having to fix the Vision by shrinking and going inside the Vision's body. And Captain Marvel gets some good moments in here and there as a guest star, too, along with the Inhumans, who, by the way, were created by the Kree.
You know, that does sound pretty epic and awesome. I mean, my only real knowledge about the Skrulls comes from the Fantastic Four always fighting the Skrulls, and, of course, the Super Skrull with all their powers. I learned a bit more about them during the Secret Invasion, but I must admit to not knowing much beyond the animated shows. As far as the Kree goes, I learned most of what I know from the Captain Marvel movie. But, I mean, I got to imagine the initial intro to all that and a big old event must have been really sweet.
Oh, that it was. I mean, the Avengers were stupidly lucky in terms of the writers that they had in their early years. I mean, after Roy Thomas finished his run, he was replaced by another legendary Avengers writer, Steve Englehart. We talked a bit about Englehart in our discussion of Cap, since Englehart also wrote that book around the same time as his Cap run. And that stuff's tied in briefly, too, because Cap took a leave of absence from the Avengers during his time as Nomad. I'll admit that I have not read the entire run on Avengers by Englehart, though I have read some of it. Englehart makes a very early splash with one story I am familiar with, though, and that is the Avengers Defenders War. Now, I admit I love the classic Defenders. I mean, you have four of the most powerful and the most unstable heroes at Marvel, and they're a team in spite of themselves. And that includes Doctor Strange, the Hulk, Namor the Submariner, and the Silver Surfer. And because of the manipulations of Loki, the Avengers had to fight those guys. The story itself does follow what is now a pretty standard format, but back then it had the virtue of not having been done that often. All in all, it's not too bad, and you get some fun stuff with the Black Knight, the Valkyrie, and others along the way. Now, I think what most people remember about Englehart is mainly two things. The first is Mantis, who most people would know from the Guardians of the Galaxy films. Forget that version. She has nothing to do with the comic book Mantis at all. The Englehart version is a lot more badass. She is a master martial artist from Vietnam who studied unarmed combat from a secret order of Kree warrior monks called the Priests of Pama. Her father was a member of the Zodiac, the criminal Zodiac, named Libra, who is a blind Pama master named Gustav Brandt. To give an idea, though, of how awesome Mantis could be, she once got a good unarmed strike on Thor, and that is just where she starts. Over time, she becomes what's called the Celestial Madonna, who is destined to be the mother of an alien messiah figure from the Katati. All this ties into a story called the Celestial Madonna Saga, which involves a huge battle between the Avengers and Kang. It's considered a classic, but unfortunately, I still haven't gotten quite that far into my reading of the Englehart run yet.
Yeah, that Mantis doesn't sound like she's on the same planet, let alone the same ballpark as the MCU character. I mean, damn. MCU basically ignored a shit ton of really cool stuff about her character and focused solely on her psychic empathy and then added the ability to control those emotions in others. They even made her a timid weakling, basically, in the MCU compared to her comics counterpart. But back to the Avengers, that fight against that lineup of Defenders sounds amazing and epic. That's a pretty scary lineup to have to face.
Oh, I know, right? I mean, I have a fondness for the classic Defenders, and I'm not going to lie about that. But to return to the Avengers, the other big development was the romance between the Vision and the Scarlet Witch. Now, from what I've seen, the groundwork was laid very slowly and methodically by Englehart, which is part of the reason it's so popular today. By the end of Englehart's run on the main Avengers book, Vision and Wanda were married, and get this bit of weirdness. The person who officiated the wedding was Immortus, as in the future version of Kang. Only in comics do things like this happen.
Oh, man. You know, accepting that Immortus was not the same evil conqueror as Kang is one thing. But letting him officiate the wedding is a whole other level I would just not be able to do personally. I mean, that's just going too far. I mean, what was the thinking there?
I have no clue, honestly. I don't think most people would have let their foreign enemy officiate their wedding, but let's move on from that. Even after Englehart left the main Avengers book, I mean, he wasn't done with the Avengers. He came back later to take over the West Coast team, which is when I discovered them. And he also did a mini with the Vision and the Scarlet Witch. But we'll get into those things in a little bit. So the next major milestone I want to talk about is the Avengers encounters with Thanos of Titan. Now, I'm going to have to correct the record a little bit when it comes to Thanos. If you watch the MCU films, you get the sense that he's primarily an Avengers villain. That has never been in the true in the comics prior to the MCU. The Jim Starlin version of Thanos has absolutely no personal animosity against any of the individual Avengers, and the Avengers as a group are little more than a nuisance to the Dark Titan. Thanos only has a few real personal enemies, including his father Mentor and his brother Eros back on Titan, Captain Mar-Vell, Adam Warlock, and the Silver Surfer. All of them are cosmic-level beings who have earned the Mad Titan's attention for some reason or another. The Avengers were usually just along for the ride when they faced Thanos at all. They usually were supporting characters to Mar-Vell or Warlock as part of their stories. So I do not consider Thanos to be an Avengers villain, at least not the true Thanos as written by Jim Starlin in the comics. Their battles are incidental at best. The Avengers have faced that version of Thanos twice back in the Bronze Age now. The first time, Thanos had taken a hold of a cosmic cube and briefly became a god. Now, even there, Thanos didn't really care much about the Avengers except to the extent that they were involved, that they were there, you know. The real enemy there was Marv, and for a very good reason. Mar-Vell's cosmic awareness discovered Thanos' weakness. So Marv shattered the seemingly powerless cosmic cube, which he realized was Thanos' power source, and Thanos lost all the powers he gained from the cube. And then he was trapped in deep space in the center of the universe. Now, Thanos got out of that situation, and then he embarked on another plan in a story called The Final Threat. Thanos used the Infinity Gems, then called the Soul Gems, to commit stellar genocide by wiping out entire stars. Oh, and as an aside, I hate the term Infinity Stones. That is an invention of the MCU, and you will not catch me using it. And anyway, that plan was put to an end by Adam Warlock, who turned Thanos into stone, at least until he was resurrected later by death. You do get to some cool fights with Thanos against the Avengers in that story. But there, too, Thanos isn't really bothered by them. Although I will point out that Thanos fights Thor and the Thing to a near standstill, and that's awesome. The Avengers are just supporting players, in what's very clearly an Adam Warlock story. Now, to be fair, though, I do want to mention one very awesome moment that I forgot to mention in our Cap episode. And that's a time when Thanos got the Infinity Gauntlet and Cap, who is the last man standing and knowing he's going to die, confronts Thanos. Cap says this, quote, "As long as one man stands against you, Thanos, you'll never be able to claim victory." And then Cap goes out fighting and he's inspiring even in death, even though it was reversed later. It's just an awesome moment, even if it's just a footnote in a story revolving around the Surfer and Warlock. Now, I love all these stories, and the Final Threat and the Infinity Gauntlet in particular are favorites of mine, but in no way are they Avengers stories at all.
Ah, that moment with Cap sounds awesome. Hell yeah. You know, I'm starting to see just how many liberties the MCU has taken with their characters, and I gotta say I'm not really digging it. It was fine before when I thought the MCU took place in a separate universe, but in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, they flat out say that the MCU is supposed to take place in Earth 616, which is the comics universe, but that might be a tangent for another time.
Oh, yeah, I agree with all that. I mean, even Iman Vellani, the actress who plays Ms. Marvel, gives Kevin Feige grief over this. But I agree that this is another conversation. Now, after this, the Avengers gets a bit more hidden, misses a title. You get some bad stories in the mix occasionally. But there's one really great story from the Jim Shooter period that I want to bring up, and that's the Korvac saga. Korvac is a villain from the 30th century, and he comes back through time, then gains cosmic power by hacking into Galactus's world ship. However, Korvac is an interesting villain because all he really wants is to create a utopia on Earth with a perfect life for him and his girlfriend, and he just wants to stay away from all the cosmic people hunting him. It doesn't work out the way he hopes, unfortunately. Now, the Korvac saga is considered one of the true classics when it comes to Avengers stories. It's not necessarily on the level of something like the Kree-Skull War or the Celestial Madonna saga or some of the others that I plan to bring up later, but I like this arc a lot, and Korvac is a really cool villain. Now, from here, we get into one of my favorite Avengers eras. I think if you were to ask most fans of the classic Avengers who their favorite writer is, many of them would pick Roger Stern. And I'll be honest, this is around the time when I first discovered them, so I do have very fond memories of this run. Stern was a writer who understood and respected the Avengers traditions, but he also found great ways to shake things up. It also helped that you had some masterful art in this book. John DeBuscema came back around this time, and he was inked by the legendary Tom Palmer. Really, really beautiful stuff. So the roster changed again, bringing in Eros of Titan into the team under the name Star Fox. Stern also introduced Monica Rambeau, who gained energy powers and became the second Captain Marvel. She would later be called Photon and Spectrum. Monica was a huge character, though, because she was an important Black female character in a major Big Two comic in the 80s. She became the chairwoman of the Avengers by the end of Stern's run. The best thing about it was that Monica really earned her place among the Avengers. I mean, she makes a lot of smart, clutch decisions at exactly the right time. She's level-headed, and she earns the trust of her teammates. Beyond that, you had some recognizable faces, too, including Cap, Thor, the Wasp, who was also chairwoman for a while under Stern. Hercules and the Black Knight. You got some really big epic stories, too, and they had an impact. While the Avengers are dealing with the original Secret Wars, the Vision gets possessed by an alien influence, and then he takes over the world's computers. The Avengers eventually come back and then have to stop the alien without destroying Vision. And that's when it starts. From there, it gets even crazier. Terminus briefly destroys the Savage Land. It was fixed later by the X-Men, but at the time it was a surprising move. Fire Lord recruits the Avengers to go into space to find Nebula, who at the time was believed to be the granddaughter of Thanos. Along the way, Nebula acquires a weapon that she uses to destroy the Skrull throne world and is stuck for a while. This is when I first came across the Avengers, and it's some really great stuff even today. But the story everyone best remembers under Stern is Under Siege, where Baron Helmut Zemo and the Masters of Evil lay siege to Avengers Mansion. Zemo assembles a very large, very dangerous group of Masters, including Moonstone, Goliath, or Atlas as he'd be called later, the Fixer, Absorbing Man and Titania, the Wrecking Crew, a new Yellow Jacket named Rita Damara, Mr. Hyde, Tiger Shark, and Blackout. Damn. Some of them would later join the Thunderbolts, and they would actually be the founding members of that group. But at the time, it was probably the biggest group of bad guys ever assembled against the Avengers. And they do a ton of damage. They brutalize Jarvis, and they even blind him in one eye for a long time. They beat Hercules so bad that they knocked him into a coma. But you get some great moments as well as dark ones. Cap and Baron Zemo get a very satisfying final battle. And when Thor finally shows up to avenge his friend Herc, it's epic. If you want to know why I love Helmut Zemo as a villain as much as I do, if you want to know where the seeds of Thunderbolts came from, read Under Siege.
That is a crazy powerful team of villains. As that happened in 1963, I have to wonder if it wasn't inspired by the Suicide Squad from The Brave and the Bold number 25 in 1959, or if it was DC who was inspired by Marvel when they created the Secret Six in 1968. Hell, I suppose it could be a bit of both. But that aside, I bet that was some really epic stuff going on there. And it wow, just based on that awesome cover from the storyline, that final fight with Cap and Zemo and all the other heroes just beat to shit all over the ground and everything's all destroyed. I mean, that is a really striking cover.
I'm not sure about Stern's influences, though I absolutely love that cover. I agree. I mean, John Buscema is easily one of the best artists ever to draw the Avengers. I think he's up there with the late, great George Perez in terms of great Avengers artists. It's a story that's hard to top, but they made a pretty good effort. Roger Stern left the Avengers on a high note in a story called Assault on Olympus. He decided to end his run with a story that was as big as he could go. And I think you may appreciate this one, Mike. The Avengers go to Mount Olympus and fight the Greek gods. Furious and grief-driven Zeus blames the Avengers for what happened to Hercules, and they are brought to Olympus to face the wrath of Zeus. Where Under Siege gets dark and serious, though, Assault on Olympus is much more fun, and it gets back to what's cool about the Avengers. I mean, the Avengers are built to take on epic and powerful foes, while also dealing with character-driven epics, and I think the Olympus story gives you what you want from that.
You're definitely right about that. That is right up my alley. I mean, you put mythology into something and you have a fan in me, and that sounds pretty crazy too. I will admit though that considering the Olympians won the war with the Titans, I have a hard time believing that the Avengers would win that fight. On the flip side of that same song, that same coin, though, considering how much they changed Thor and Hercules from the myth, I have to imagine they took some liberties there as well, too. But all of that aside, that sounds like a pretty awesome storyline.
I think you're right on that. And yes, it is a lot of fun. I also want to talk briefly about the West Coast Avengers, because Stern was responsible for starting that book, or at least he was the original writer who was attached to the miniseries leading into it. But I guess Stern couldn't do WCA since he was also doing Avengers and Spider-Man around that time. So when the ongoing West Coast book started, it went back to a known quantity, Steve Englehart. This is where I started becoming familiar with him. I enjoyed his run on WCA as a kid, and I read it heavily in my teens. But while I don't think it's bad now, I don't think it aged that well either. Still, it's an important book because it gives some of the other Avengers a place to shine in a different context. I mean, after years of ragging on Cap, Hawkeye had to put his money where his mouth is, and he became the Avenger, the chairman of the West Coast team. He also got married to Mockingbird, who was a former S.H.I.E.L.D. agent named Bobby Morse, and their marriage was a big part of the book for a while. The other original wackos included Jim Rhodes, who was Iron Man at the time, an Ionic powerhouse, an actor named Wonder Man, and a werecat by the name of Tigra. Eventually, you'd get some other notable characters in the mix. Hank Pym joined the team as a scientific adventurer, not wanting to change size again and having recently divorced the Wasp. Tony Stark took over as Iron Man again, and he joined the group. You also got some odd recruits like The Thing, very briefly, Firebird, and even Moon Knight. But then you started getting some pretty good additions like the Vision of the Scarlet Witch, I mean, John Walker as U.S. Agent, and the original Human Torch from the Invaders. The book gradually went off the rails after Englehart left, unfortunately. I mean, John Byrne came in and his run was a bit mixed. I wasn't a fan of what he did with Vision and Wanda, for instance. But you got some fun stuff like the Great Lakes Avengers out of that run, too. I have fond memories of the WCA, but when it finally ended, I can't say the book had to run its course.
I'm kind of curious. What did Byrne do with Vision and Wanda that you didn't like?
Oh, boy. I'll preface it by saying this. For all his flaws, John Byrne is a writer-artist that I respect a great deal, even when I disagree with him. When he's on fire, he is great. But he also tends to be self-indulgent and a bit too anal when it comes to realism and detail, and he loves hitting the retcon button way too much. You kind of get both the good and the bad flavors on Byrne on his WCA run. Now, Byrne never liked the idea of Vision and Wanda being together, mainly on the basis that he saw Vision as a soulless robot. Which, by the way, he's not. Vision is a synthezoid. He's more like an artificial human in the way that a replicant is, even though that's not 100% accurate. Now, that whole interpretation destroyed decades of characterization. He didn't think Vision and Wanda should have had kids, and so he set out to correct everything that Englehart had set up. So Byrne basically had the Vision dismantled, wiped away his entire personality, and had him act more robotic. Then he decided to have Wanda's kids magically fade away and split up Vision and Wanda. This set up a romance between Wanda and Wonder Man. Now, in fairness, I think Byrne had a point with that bit. Vision's brain patterns were based on Wonder Man's. So, I mean, it makes sense that they'd have the same taste in women. Other writers have made that idea work, Busiek in addition to other people. But the way that everything was cleared away is hated by a lot of Vision fans, especially Vision and Wanda shippers. Byrne was also the one who set the precedent for Dark Wanda with all the Mephisto stuff at the end of his run. Byrne's self-indulgence, I think, comes into play here, too, because he has a weird fixation with turning these powerful Marvel heroines into villains. He did it with Dark Phoenix, which was great, and he did it with the Invisible Woman with the Malice storyline. Now, granted, he's ripping himself off here, but I think Byrne wore out the welcome of that trope when he used it on Wanda. Later writers spent years in undoing all this stuff, especially Kurt Busiek, but I'll get into that a bit later on.
Wow. I can see why you had an issue with it. You know, it is astounding how many times the Measure of the Man episode from Star Trek The Next Generation comes up in science fiction discussions. And it sounds those like Byrne. And it sounds like Byrne maybe could have used a viewing of that right before writing Vision, because he didn't understand that measure at all. I think you're right about wearing out his welcome with turning Wanda into a villain, too. I loved the Dark Phoenix storyline. I mean, it was captivating. And I also love seeing the dark side of Sue Richards with Malice. I mean, she did cruel things with her powers that I hadn't even thought of before. Granted, my experience with both of these is from the animated shows of the X-Men and the Fantastic Four, but still, I am noticing something here that I had not before, and that is Brian Michael Bendis apparently picked up his Evil Wanda storyline from Byrne. So I'm seeing a link in your dislikes here.
Yes, you're absolutely right on all that. Bendis took what Byrne did and ramped it up to 11. It was doubling down on a bad take that had previously been cleared away before he took over. I also agree with you on Dark Phoenix and Malice. I mean, I think Byrne handled those stories well, in my view. With Sue particularly, it set up an awesome battle between her and Psycho Man and Fantastic Four, cementing her as the Invisible Woman we know today. But I never felt that we got that kind of arc with Wanda, and it wasn't done nearly as well. Anyway, though, the 90s got pretty weird for the Avengers. The X-Men became the top-selling book in the world, and the Avengers were kind of lost in the shuffle. So they brought in Bob Harrows, who at the time was the editor of the X-Men books, and an artist named Steve Epting. Epting was nowhere near the artist he is today, or even back when he did Captain America, but he did some really strong work on the book. But I think the book visually was best known for the 90s visual elements. Everybody was wearing leather jackets, and the Black Knight was using a lightsaber instead of his magical ebony blade. But I will say that in the Harris run's favor, that the lineup was interesting. Black Knight, Hercules, Crystal of the Inhumans, Circe of the Eternals, Black Widow, and the Vision were the main group. Though others did come in and out of the team. Those are some pretty interesting characters. And I will admit that Circe in particular is a favorite of mine. At the same time, I don't think Harris quite got the Avengers. I think the idea was to give the book more of an edge and to make them more like the X-Men were in tone. But that's just not who the Avengers really are, and the team's sense of identity suffered for it a bit. So after a while, people got tired of 90s-style comics trends, and the stories gradually lost direction. Harris eventually left as well, and that led into an event called The Crossing, which is generally considered one of the worst Avengers stories ever. It's so despised that it was later retconned out of existence and never referred to again. It was also so bad that they followed The Crossing by giving the Avengers to Rob Liefeld and Jim Lee for a year. And that became Heroes Reborn. I haven't read a whole lot of that myself, though, so I can't really comment on details. But if your story is so hated that it led to the characters being out of play for an entire year and the story was buried for decades, you've done something wrong.
I got to agree with you there. As a quick side note, though, I have to ask, is Circe from the Eternals the same Circe from the Odyssey?
Yes. She's the one that turned Odysseus' crew into pigs and all that. Yeah, that's been brought up.
Ah, I see why she's a favorite of yours then.
Yep, absolutely.
So I haven't read either The Crossing or Heroes Reborn because I have heard zero good things about both of them. And after hearing that, my opinion is even more cemented now.
It's considered a low point, but thankfully it was retconned later. I mean, Heroes Reborn was not great, and Liefeld and Lee's contract ran out, so the Avengers were brought back into the Marvel Universe. Now, I will say that I love Heroes Return. They brought some of the best rising creators on board, and they let them loose. This is how you got Mark Waid and Ron Garney back for a second run on Cap. But I think the most relevant name we should talk about here is Kurt Busiek. Busiek had been involved with Big Two Comics since the 80s, though nobody took notice of him until he did Marvels with Alex Ross. Then he started grabbing attention with books like Untold Tales of Spider-Man. But Kurt Busiek was a fan of the Avengers since the 70s, and he was strongly influenced by the Steve Englehart run. In fact, he'd even interviewed Englehart for Marvel Age during the WCA years. The guy's devoted. Busiek has always been a continuity-focused writer, and he was good at digging up the most obscure things in Marvel history and making them cool. But he became a shoo-in for Avengers after his run on Thunderbolts, which took the Masters of Evil and built a book about villains seeking redemption. That book is awesome, and it took a lot from the Avengers mythos, and it built its own corner of the Marvel Universe. By the time Heroes Return rolled around, Kurt Busiek was a huge favorite to take over Avengers, which is exactly what happened. Better still, they got George Perez to come back to the Avengers to draw the Heroes Return line. Oh, yeah. The run starts with a story called The Morgan Conquest. Every Avenger is summoned for a battle against Morgan Le Fay, who uses something called the Twilight Sword to rewrite reality with her in charge of the universe. It's pretty fun stuff as you get Arthurian Avenger versions of all the Avengers, many of whom are mind controlled by Morgan. Cap and a few other holdouts team up to stop Morgan. Hilarity ensues, and then after Morgan is defeated, the world returns to normal. It's a pretty solid start to the Buzik Perez run, and sets the tone of the book well.
I have to say, I'm intrigued by Morgan Le Fay and the Twilight Sword, which I believe is from Norse mythology. I'm not sure how I feel about Arthurian Avengers, but all in all, that does sound like a fun story.
Yeah, it's a brief alternate reality story, but the motif is interesting, and it did what it was meant to do. It set up the new team. The Heroes Return lineup is very old school and traditional, but you do get new people, too. The main additions are Justice and Firestar, two of the original New Warriors who graduated to Avenger status. At this point, they're in a long-term relationship, and I admit I love their romance, and I love them together. Justice is a telekinetic and the younger version of Vance Astro of the original Guardians of the Galaxy. Firestar you probably know from Spider-Man and his amazing friends. But their attitudes bring a good grounded viewpoint to the team. Vance is the kid who's living the dream, and he's struggling to live up to these legends. And Firestar is the reluctant heroine who ends up being inspired by the other Avengers in spite of her own reluctance. Carol Danvers also came back under the name Warbird. And while I liked what Buzik tried to do, I think there were mixed results with her. But the starting lineup is really good between Justice, Firestar, Cap, Thor, Wanda, Hawkeye, Warbird, and a newly resurrected Wonder Man. Don't ask. I'm not going to say that Buzik is a better Avengers writer than somebody like a Roger Stern, but I do think he's the best writer since Stern. And I think that Kurt understands the Avengers better than anyone I've seen on the book in the modern age. He understands the proceduralism, the morality of the Avengers, the character-driven storytelling and the soap opera. He knows how to make the threats truly epic and dangerous, and he knows how to make superheroes fun. He knows who these characters are more than most writers I've seen, and he gets their history. But he also took risks, and he changed the dynamics from time to time as well, while also knowing how to tell fan-pleaser stories. He balanced all of those things very well. Now, I do have some quibbles with the Buzik run, things I don't disagree with him about, but I feel like his understanding of the Avengers as a whole is second to none. And for that reason, it's probably my favorite run, even if it's not the run I started with.
I can see why you feel that way after how you described Byrne's lack of understanding ruining things. I mean, Stern must have felt like a cold glass of water on a summer day by comparison. I guess that is the problem when you start dealing with individual interpretations on the same text and, you know, needing to stretch boundaries or shake things up to bring something new to the table.
Oh, pretty much. I mean, sometimes you need a Stern or a Kurt Buzik to bring a book back to its core, as Avengers did here. So I'll talk about the two most notable Buzik stories, the ones that usually make most Avengers stories lists. The first is Avengers Forever, a maxi series that Kirk did on the side while he was also doing Avengers and Iron Man. Carlos Pacheco drew this series, and I think it's some of his finest work, especially given the sheer amount of minutiae he drew in this. Now, Roger Stern would eventually come in to assist on it, too, because Buzik was suffering from a bout of mercury poisoning at the time, and it was affecting his output. But, I mean, it's awesome. And Kang and Immortus are fighting a war across time called the Destiny War. And the Avengers are recruited from across time and space to help put an end to it. So you get Wasp and Giant Man from the present, past versions of Cap and Hawkeye, Yellowjacket, who is a crazy version of Hank from the past, Rick Jones, and future versions of Songbird and Jenis Vell, the son of Captain Mar-Vell. It's admittedly a Klaus cleaning story that's designed to make sense of a lot of bad ideas and bad stories, but it does so in a logical and entertaining way. It also does this in a way that makes Immortus a truly more dangerous and insidious villain. Now, I don't recommend coming into this series cold unless you know at least a little bit about Avengers history, though Buzik does explain it. But even if you do, you get some really cool stuff. The 1950s Atlas heroes who became Agents of Atlas show up. There's a great issue focusing on Kang's past and motivations, and also issue on Immortus and the Space Phantoms. The last issue is an all-out war involving Avengers from all across time and their enemies, all while Kang and Immortus fight to the last to determine their future. I really want to read the story again now as I describe this to you.
You know, I have to admit that having that stuff in it to explain Kang and his motivation makes me want to read it too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Avengers Forever makes sense of a lot of really dumb stories, including The Crossing, but it never feels like it's just there to retcon things. I mean, there's a larger story going on with some great development for Kang. The other great music story is Ultron Unlimited, which I believe I touched on briefly during our Thor discussion. It's probably Ultron at his most evil, and that's really saying something when talking about a genocidal murder bot. Ultron takes over the country of Solaridia, and he wipes out the entire population of the country on live TV. Damn. It's chilling. And then he kidnaps various people that comprise his extended family, mainly the Pyms, the Vision, Wonder Man, and his brother, the villainous Green Reaper. When the Avengers come to save their friends, you get easily one of the most epic Thor moments I've ever seen, but I've already mentioned that in the Thor episode. Even better, George Perez draws the whole thing, and man, does he bring it. Solaridia looks like a ravaged war zone, and the scene where the Avengers come to the rescue looks badass and epic. Now, music also tries to end with a bang with an epic called The Kang War. There are bits that are really cool, especially the Alan Davis issues in the beginning. You also get Kang with the brakes off as he at one point succeeds in taking over the world. However, I think the story dragged out a bit too long. There were midstream art changes that didn't really help. And at times, there was a lack of narrative focus. I can't be sure, but I can't help but wonder if Kurt Busiek's health was getting to him around this time. Regardless, I feel like the Kang War could have been more than it was, but the run still ends on a decent note as a whole.
You know, changing people working on the story at any point and telling it is going to be bad in my experience. Granted, these are movies, but I would give examples of Suicide Squad and Justice League if you want examples of how crappy that can go. But to do that in the middle and then just come back to that, it just makes that whole middle section a huge dip in the flow of the story.
Oh, right. It's just an unforeseen circumstance. But there was a bright spot on the horizon. I originally was excited for the next run because Geoff Johns took over Avengers after Busiek finished his run. And I admitted that I liked the lineup on that one a lot. Cap, Iron Man, Black Panther, Thor, Falcon, She-Hulk, Scarlet Witch, Ant-Man, the Wasp, and Namor were involved at various points. It was a big lineup, but this was Geoff Johns around the time that he wrote JSA. So, you know, big lineups were his thing at the time. Unfortunately, I don't think Geoff's Avengers were quite as good as his DC work. Not that it was bad or anything, just that he seemed to struggle more with it. And that run had some really weird scenes of ideas. Did we really need to see Savage She-Hulk, for instance? Or Hank and Jan getting it on while size changing? At the same time, I felt like the adversarial relationship between Tony and T'Challa was great. And Geoff Johns seemed to do pretty well with characters like Falcon, too.
Wow. You know, I don't know if I've told you this before, but Geoff Johns is actually one of my favorites. And I had no idea he worked for Marvel at all. That's pretty cool. I'm intrigued by the adversarial relationship between Tony and T'Challa, too. I think I might have to check that out.
Oh, yeah. Look it up. He did a little bit of Marvel work before DC nailed him down. I mean, Avengers was the only Geoff's only big run on a major title, but he did a couple of minis here and there, too. But then Geoff Johns left Avengers and he took his exclusive contract with DC. So that was pretty much it. But it gives you an idea of what his Marvel work is like. After that, the book started to really go downhill. And I guess Marvel decided they needed to do a huge shakeup on the Avengers to get people interested again. The next major run I want to talk about is a run that I unfortunately can't talk about with much positivity. And that's the Brian Michael Bendis run. Now, in fairness, there is a lot of Bendis's writing that I liked before this. I've praised his Daredevil run highly and still do. I also really like the early run that he did on Ultimate Spider-Man. I love his run on Alias with Jessica Jones. I mean, he gets the street corner of Marvel. But Bendis is a guy whose strength is writing teen heroes and street-level crime noir. He was not a good fit for the Avengers, unfortunately, and he made a lot of changes that I honestly still dislike to this day. Now, Avengers Disassembled, where he started, is very much the kind of drastic clearing away of the old that tends to lose me from the jump, and it comes across as disrespectful to the fans who were reading it before. People who had been major characters since the Geoff Johns run, like Jack of Hearts and Scott Lang, were casually killed off to make room for the new. Avengers Mansion is just blown up, which works as a shock moment, but it feels more like the story brushing aside something the writer didn't want to deal with. So between all that, I'm already not coming into this run with a lot of goodwill. But I think the treatment of Wanda bothered me the most. Bendis essentially ignored everything that Kurt Busiek established with the Scarlet Witch, including the nature and existence of chaos magic. Between the story and the House of M, I mean, Bendis turned her into a villain and a mad woman with reality warping powers. I don't feel like she should be, Her power is probability manipulation, which is a lot more interesting. The chaos magic, at very least, explains how Wanda sometimes does things that are impossible and not just merely improbable. Disassemble tries to hand wave chaos magic away, except that Doctor Strange should know it exists, and no less than Agatha Harkness taught the chaos magic to her. So that doesn't make any sense to me. I'm also not a fan of the heel turn. I mean, Wanda showed no signs of instability until Burn, which later writers would often ignore, and Burt Busick full-on retconned. Wanda could be troubled, sure, and she struggled with her family problems and the loss of her kids, sure, but she was in a place of acceptance by the time of Busick's run. She was even stable enough that she was voted in as deputy chairman during the Busick run, and she did a credible job at that role. So I don't buy her suddenly losing it the way she did, and this move just disconnected me from the character because I can't reconcile any of it with who Wanda was before that. And then towards the end of his run, Busick retconned Wanda's parentage so that she isn't even a mutant and Magneto isn't her father, which takes away a huge part of her character and background.
I have to say that I didn't like taking away Wanda's and Pietro's heritage when we met them in the Avengers movie Age of Ultron. I figured it was retconned because of the rights issues with the X-Men properties, but according to what you just said, at least with Wanda, that the first happened in Bendis's comics. I'm starting to pick up the MCU's fascination with Bendis stories.
Yeah, I think you're right on the rights issues, but this happened, like, I think late in Bendis's run. So, yeah. Anyway, Bendis casts a lot of her shadow on the MCU, and he always has, but what Bendis replaced the previous Avengers with just did not work for me on a conceptual level. The procedural element of the Avengers, gone. More than that, I feel like Bendis overlooked a major point about the Avengers as a team since the beginning, and which has only gotten worse since Disassembled over the years, and that's this. Avengers do not kill. That is a key article in the Avengers bylaws. We've seen Avengers get kicked out of the team in the past for killing people. So, of course, we get Wolverine on the team. There's just no way that a bloody thirsty guy like Logan works as an Avenger. And I'm very glad that he was quietly phased out later. Now, to be fair, you do have Black Widow on the team, who's a trained assassin. But she's an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. who's licensed to kill people legally. And she never kills when she's working with the Avengers. Logan is neither of these things. I feel like Bendis' approach would be much more suited to a Secret Avengers or Savage Avengers type of group, which fits his street-level approach and would have allowed for killers to be part of the cast. And there's also the problem that the new Avengers team was really unbalanced and was not addressed well. You have a group of mostly street-level guys like Cap, Spidey, Spider-Woman, Luke Cage, and Wolverine, Iron Man, who's a solid military hero, and the Sentry, who is ludicrously powerful, like cosmic-level Superman powerful. Not helping is the point that Bendis has a problem with Deus Ex Machina endings, where somebody comes in at the last minute and magically fixes the problem. Now, with New Avengers, the Deus Ex Machina comes in with the Sentry, who flies in to rescue the Avengers before flying off again. I mean, if you have the Sentry who can come in and fix any problem because he has the power of a million exploding suns, what do you need the others for? And if you can't challenge the Sentry, why is he there? So his inclusion in the Avengers never worked for me. All of this is leaving aside that Sentry is completely insane and a ticking time bomb that can't be controlled. I get that Marvel was trying to shake up the Avengers and get people interested. I don't deny that it made its money. Certain elements that didn't work at first were admittedly improved over time. There are even ideas here and there that I like. Spider-Woman was a good character to bring in, and I thought Secret Invasion was a really cool idea. Trying to boost the status of low-tier characters like the Hood is something I respect as well. But as a fan, I feel like they moved too far away from what the Avengers is supposed to be at its core. And at least in some respects, I still don't think the Avengers have recovered from the Bendis era, especially given how much of it was adapted in the MCU. I'm looking at you, WandaVision and Multiverse of Madness.
The new Avengers stuff is where I jumped on after my long hiatus from comics. It was the one jumping on point that I could find without having to read a million back issues. Finding a good place to jump onto an ongoing continuity is not easy, and for that reason, I liked it. So when things didn't quite click with how I remembered them, I just wrote it off as stuff I missed and hoped they might explain themselves later. Plus, I was not aware of the bylaws and regulations and parliamentary procedures within the Avengers when I read it. The team was a bit awkward together, but they formed out of necessity after the prison break from the raft in the maximum security installation of Rikers Island. So the fact that they didn't mesh well with each other, and it felt expected, like the wrong people got caught up in the wrong situation and had to make the best of it. But it didn't hold my interest long, as I only read 3 or 4 volumes of it. I found that I was enjoying the solo titles more at that point. And if I'm being honest, I'm not a big fan of the Sentry, especially with having to read those cheesy Golden Age adventures of him. I hated the art. I hated the story. I just couldn't wait for it to get over. I tried really hard to like the Sentry, but it was just too much chaos and weirdness. I did, however, thoroughly enjoy Sentry's penchant for ripping people in half from top to bottom in glorious, gory mess like he did to Ares. Yes, that Ares, the god of war.
Oh, man, I can't believe I forgot Ares. But yes, you're right. That's another character I can give Bendis credit for. I did like what was done with him. I mean, especially giving him a son to humanize him a bit. He's kind of like Marvel's answer to Kratos from God of War, and that's pretty cool. As to your other points, I think the problem is that they were trying to bring in a new audience and took the older readers for granted, which is an attitude I really don't like. I think you can appeal to both old and new fans, but it involves putting in the work to keep things consistent and explain changes when needed. But let's move on. I actually haven't read that much of the next run I want to mention, so I don't feel like I can talk about it that much in detail. But I think if you were to ask a lot of more recent fans what their favorite Avengers run is, they'd probably point to Jonathan Hickman. I honestly don't feel like I can, and that's because his work just doesn't speak to me. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not my intention to bash him. I think he's a talented writer. He's a good ideas guy, and he comes up with some really clever and imaginative approaches to the books he does. I totally get why this run has his fans. It's just not for me. I just feel like Hickman's writing just tends to be more slowly paced than I prefer. I can't emotionally connect to the characters that he writes. I tried the first couple of issues of his Avengers. I just couldn't stick with it. His writing just leaves me cold. Sometimes that happens. I mean, sometimes there's just not a connection and it's nobody's fault. Still, I think I could talk a little about what Hickman has done that stuck. He created the Black Order, which are Thanos' minions that we saw in the Infinity War film. Those characters had enough staying power, and it makes sense for Thanos to have death cultists who are true believers in his cause. He also gave us the second Secret Wars storyline, which his Avengers run led into. Now, while I think Secret Wars has some problems, I mean, especially the God Doom versus Thanos scene, I hate it. There is more good than bad in it. I think the idea of God Doom ruling over the dying embers of the multiverse is a really awesome premise. And I enjoyed the FF side of it and some of the tie-ins that we saw. So from what I gather, though, Hickman handled the setup to that well in his Avengers stories.
It seems like the God Doom thing might happen a lot. I remember in the Marvel's Ultimate Alliance game that Doom stole Odin's power and became a god for a time. Also, as a side note, I love those games and the X-Men Legends games that were a lot like them. I liked using Cap. That shield bouncing around the room did a hell of a lot of damage and made rooms full of enemies much easier. But I guess my question is the whole God Doom thing something that has happened several times?
Oh, very much so. Now, taking over the world and becoming a god are Doom's typical goals. Now, as an aside, I also really enjoyed Marvel Ultimate Alliance games. I mean, I admit, I mainly played as Deadpool because that character is broken. Completely right. Broken. But my favorite is Ultimate Alliance 2, which took the Civil War storyline, and it told it a bit better. Ultimate Alliance 3 came out recently, but it was very MCU-ified and not that great to me. But 1 and 2 are really solid stuff. But to get back to your God Doom question, I mean, Doom has an impressive success record by the standards of comic villains. He's taken over the world more than once, but he's also very well known for seizing godhood a few times. The first time he did it, he used his technology to steal the power of the Silver Surfer, and the FF had to stop him. The moment when Doom steals the Surfer's powers is one of my favorite Kirby panels. The first time I remember was in the original Secret Wars, where Doom challenged the Beyonder to single combat. And there, too, he beat him and became a god. In fact, there's a really crazy moment where Doom actually kills most of the remaining heroes with a bolt of the blue. Doom loses his power and the whole thing's reversed, but that's a moment that stuck with me. It was just a great visual impact. He also makes a play for the Infinity Gauntlet twice, though he fails both times. Now, the second time, he comes really close, though. He and Kang come within seconds of gaining ultimate power before their scheming and the Magus ultimately put an end to that idea. But all in all, I put Doom second only to Thanos in terms of their success rate at season godhood.
Wow, that is an impressive rating. And I feel like I see now why Doom is a favorite of yours. And I got to admit, I think you might be a new favorite of mine as well.
That's great. Doom is awesome, both in terms of his track record and his complexity as a character. He might be worth covering more properly one day. But to finish things off, I'll just mention one last Avengers run I really enjoyed. The Avengers run that I stuck with the most post-Bendis was the Al Ewing run. Ewing today is probably best known for his Immortal Hulk run, and that probably is his best work to date. But he told some pretty good Avengers stories over the course of a number of spin-off books. He started a rebooted run of New Avengers with Luke Cage leading a team. But Ewing's strength is taking a lot of really lower-tier Avengers characters and building a good cast out of them. He really made me like the new White Tiger, Ava Ayala, who was kind of like the darker character of the group. I ended up especially loving Ewing's version of the Blue Marvel, who is essentially a Superman slash Doc Savage type character from the 60s who was forced into retirement because of his race. He did a decent job with Monica Rambeau after she'd been tossed aside for years. Ewing went out of his way to take characters that were dismissed like that and make them all vital members of his cast. The story evolved a lot as Ewing took his Avengers from book to book, and they all ended, unfortunately, ending with the Avengers trying to reform a splinter cell of AIM under the leadership of Sunspot. You had good attention to continuing character, some reinventions of overlooked heroes, and crazy new ideas all thrown in a blender. Really good stuff if you want a more modern Avengers run that feels like the Avengers. But I think that hits the high points of the comics, so why don't we get into the animated films, Mike?
Sure, Steve. We've actually covered a lot of the three animated Avengers series in the Captain America discussion, so I won't rehash all of that here. But I can give you some basics that we didn't cover in that episode. There have been three animated Avengers series over the years. The first animated series was The Avengers United They Stand, and it was produced by Avi Arad and consisted of 13 episodes running from October in 1999 until it was canceled in February of 2000. The team included two founding members in Ant-Man and the Wasp and introduces Wonder Man, Tigra, Hawkeye, Falcon, Vision, and Scarlet Witch. The team was broadly based on the roster for the 1984 Avengers spinoff series, The West Coast Avengers, that Steve talked about earlier. The show made several comic book references, such as Falcon and Captain America's partnership, Hawkeye's partial deafness, or Namor being half-breed. However, that was where any similarities to the comic ended, as they completely redesigned a majority of the characters from the uniforms to their history. I think the biggest one was having Ant-Man or Giant-Man, Wasp, Hawkeye and Falcon all wear suits of battle armor. But also Tigra's past was changed to having been an athlete who went through a genetic treatments to give her an edge in competition, but the procedure went bad and she ended up with the form and abilities of a tiger.
Well, that has nothing to do with Tigra from the comic, but okay. Now, United We Stand was a little odd, and I admit I've only watched bits of it. I really didn't get the decision to put Avengers in battle armor, especially since comic accurate costumes work really well in animation usually. The lineup was solid, but I do wonder why the big three weren't a huge part of the show. I mean, I can't help but wonder if it was a rights issue. The Masters of Evil episode that we discussed previously, I think it was the Cap episode, wasn't too bad though.
You know, since United They Stand came out in 1999, I think you might have hit the nail on the head there as far as why Thor, Cap, and Iron Man weren't there. I don't know for certain, obviously, but with all of Marvel's rights to their character issues that they had from almost going bankrupt being a problem back then, I don't doubt that at all. The second Avengers show, and this one is my favorite for the record, was The Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes, which debuted on Disney XD and online in the fall of 2010. The series started out with a 20-part microseries of ridiculously short episodes that were later broadcast as 5 television episodes. Imagine that. 20 episodes shrunk down to 5. That's how short they were. In the second season, it was one of the inaugural shows of the Marvel Universe's programming block along Ultimate Spider-Man. The Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes original team was based on the roster for the original Avengers, composed of Iron Man, Giant Man, Hulk, Thor, and Wasp. The team's later joined by Captain America, Black Panther, and Hawkeye in the first season, and Miss Marvel and Vision in the second season. The stories in the series were all interconnected and told an overall larger story through a series of smaller stories, and I freaking love that. I'm not a big fan of a series with just standalone stories that aren't interconnected. I really need that larger story to stay invested. But throughout the show, the Avengers battle some big names as far as supervillains go, like Baron Zemo, the leader, Kang the Conqueror, Ultron, Loki, Enchantress, as well as the criminal organizations of Hydra and AIM. They also battled Doctor Doom, Thunderbolt Ross, and the Red Skull, as well as alien threats such as the Skrulls, the Kree, and Galactus. This grand scale and so many big baddies also made it feel a lot more like reading the comic. In fact, even the stories themselves, while deriving from multiple sources, including the comics and the MCU, were reminiscent of the old Silver Age comics by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. The series also had a crap ton of guest stars, including Spider-Man, Wolverine, Scott Lang and his daughter Cassandra, Heroes for Hire, Crossfire, the Guardians of the Galaxy, Quake, Beta Ray Bill, the Falcon, and the Winter Soldier.
Huh. I keep hearing that Earth's Mightiest Hero was a good, really good show, but I still haven't seen much of it. I mean, it's a shame that that show only lasted for a couple seasons, because it seems like it had enough going for it that it should have gone longer. Everything you described sounds like it was done right to me. I mean, the cast is really great. I really can't argue with that roster of villains. I mean, Dr. Doom is my all-time favorite villain, so I'm never not going to be down for an episode of Doom being down on the Avengers. It does seem like it took some elements from the MCU, but not so much that it dilutes the core of what made the Avengers work as a series. I really should find some time to sit down and watch that one day.
While I do not have the deep history with the Avengers that you do, I have to compare it with, I have a hard time believing that you wouldn't love it too. But let's get into the next animated series, The Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes, one of the best animated comic series, period, was replaced by an inferior show, in my opinion. It was not bad, but after loving its predecessor so much, Avengers Assembles felt like a step down writing-wise. However, this was apparently not a popular opinion, as Earth's Mightiest Heroes only got 2 seasons, and Avengers Assembles somehow got 5. But the basic premise of the series is that Falcon, as the main eyes and ears of the viewer, is the newest member of the Avengers and fights evil and saves the world with his teammates, Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, Hulk, and briefly Red Hulk, Black Widow, Hawkeye, Black Panther, Captain Marvel, Miss Marvel, and Ant-Man. But they do bring some heavy hitters for them to fight in this series, brought together by the Red Skull in an organization called the Cabal, including Atuma, Dracula, Justin Hammer's robot creation, Super Adaptoid, and Hyperion, an alien psychopath believing himself to be a superhero. They attempted to recruit Dr. Doom, but he declined. But the big bad guys keep coming, with Thanos, Ultron, who drains the power of the Infinity Stones and possesses Arsenal's body, Squadron Supreme, AIM Scientist Supreme, Baron Helmet Zemo, the Masters of Evil, Kang the Conqueror, Whiplash, Spymaster, the Leader, Enchantress, Executioner Loki, the Beyonder, the Atlanteans, Killmonger, and so many others.
Yeah, I can't say I was really interested in that one, if I'm honest. Now, it didn't seem to have the same energy, although I will say that that lineup of villains looked really cool, if nothing else.
That's totally understandable, and I don't think you're missing much. But let's get into a couple of the animated movies. Avengers, Ultimate Avengers the movie is the first film in the Marvel animated features based loosely on the first 6 issues of The Ultimates by Mark Miller and Brian Hitch. The film was released on February 21st, 2006, and produced by Dongwu Animation. The movie focuses on Captain America, a super soldier who was frozen in ice for about 60 years after stopping a Nazi extraterrestrial plot in 1945. The captain is assigned to lead a team of heroes found by General Nick Fury of S.H.I.E.L.D. to fight an alien threat. Ultimate Avengers 2, Rise of the Panther, is the second film in the series and a sequel to The Ultimate Avengers the movie. The film was released on August 8, 2006. In the film, the Black Panther teams up with the Ultimate Avengers to continue their fight against the aliens when they invade Africa. As I mentioned, the Cap episode, I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed these two Ultimate Avengers movies. But I do not have the long-standing fandom that you had with them, Steve. So, I mean, sure, things were different, but I liked the changes, especially the Cap.
That's fair to me. I think the Ultimate Avengers film tried to ride the line between the Ultimates and the Avengers, hence the name. I really did not like the Ultimates as a comic. I felt like none of those the Ultimates were likable characters in any way, and it just did not feel like the Avengers at all. But the animated films toned down a lot of the problems I had with the Ultimates while keeping the general trappings. So that's at least an approach I can live with, even if it's not what I personally prefer as an Avengers fan.
Fair enough. And actually, that's a better response than I thought I was going to get, so I'll take it. But let's talk about the Avengers from the MCU. The first Avengers movie came out in 2012 as the final film in phase one of the MCU, and it was very satisfying. I remember walking away feeling like I had just watched the greatest superhero movie ever made. I mean, I was particularly blown away by getting to see so many big name characters in one film. I imagine it was a lot like when kids first picked up the Justice League or Avengers comics and first saw their favorite heroes in one spot. I couldn't stop talking about how awesome it was for weeks. But I did have one huge complaint about it, and it's a complaint that I still have, honestly. I was pissed to see that Edward Norton was replaced as Bruce Banner by Mark Ruffalo. I love the darker, more serious Hulk from the Incredible Hulk movie, and Ruffalo is no Edward Norton, who I consider to be one of the better actors I have ever seen. Also, there was some friction between Tony Stark and Steve Rogers in the film, granted mostly on the part of Tony, that I was interested. It's interesting, even if it made Tony seem a little petty and a bit immature. While Cap seemed like the obvious choice for the leader of the team, the MCU made a decent case for Tony Stark filling that role too. In fact, if you look for it, you can see the seeds of what would be the MCU's Civil War being planted there in that first film, and especially as the franchise went on. I found this quote from Chris Evans about the relationship between Steve and Tony to be interesting. Evans said, "I think there's a certainly a dichotomy, this kind of friction between myself and Tony Stark. They're polar opposites. One guy is a flash and spotlight and smooth, and the other guy is selfless and in the shadows and kind of quiet, and they have to get along. They explore that, and it's pretty fun."
I absolutely love the first film, and you can tell it was made by people who love the comic. The basic setup was much along the lines of the comics version with Loki as a villain, but you got a really grand story worthy of the Avengers with an alien invasion and the team assembling to save New York. At the same time, you also get these moments that are reminiscent of classic comics, especially the fights between the individual Avengers and what are basically misunderstanding battles. I really loved all that, and to this day, I will always have a fondness for Avengers 1 because it feels most like a proper comic book film. I don't think that the later films ever quite captured that in the same way. As for Tony and Cap, I really put that down to Tony being territorial and the fact that he hates not being in charge. And some of it's probably lingering resentment of being dragged into the Avengers by Fury. Robert Downey's Tony is a lot more immature than you typically see in the comic, but I do like that he usually comes through in a clutch, as we see at the end. When Cap challenges him to make the sacrifice play, Tony finds it within himself to do exactly that. It's a good character arc. But everyone gets some really good moments in this for the most part. I'll also add that this is the moment where I really became a fan of the Black Widow. Natasha was always this cool, mysterious character, but you never really understood her until this film. When she talks about the red on her ledger, all the blood on her hands as a former assassin, I feel like she finally clicked into place for me. And she gets some truly awesome scenes, both in her introduction and later on when she plays the God of Lies like a harp. The only character that I think got into service was Hawkeye, who's just not that interesting compared to the comic version, but Whedon was working with what he had on that one. All in all, this is a textbook superhero film, and it's still amazing.
We're agreed on all of that. And we also came to understand Black Widow in the same way. I mean, I didn't care about her much at all until the first Avengers film. The Avengers was praised for Whedon's direction and screenplay, visual effects, action sequences, acting, and musical score. And it took 38 awards and 80 nominations, including one Oscar and a BAFTA nominations for achievements in visual effects. The film grossed over $1.5 billion worldwide and set some records, too, including becoming the third highest grossing film of all time, at least at the time of its release, anyway, and the highest grossing film of 2012, as well as the first Marvel production to generate $1 billion in ticket sales. In 2017, The Avengers was featured as one of the 100 greatest films of all time in an Empire magazine poll.
For good reason, I think. Later films seem to overshadow it in popularity now, but this movie set the standards for superhero films for a very long time.
That it did. It was certainly my basis of comparison for quite a while. The next Avengers movie was Age of Ultron, where the tension between Stark and Rogers reached the next level, as it should. In Age of Ultron, we see the divide between Steve and Tony growing even wider as Tony attempts to get peace in our time by using the Ultron program to put a shield around the world. But even Stark's friend Banner thinks this is a bit crazy, and both he and Cap end up being right about the effects. But this did not deter Stark's thinking at all. The events in Sokovia, the countless deaths and unrivaled destruction caused mostly by Ultron, sparked the civil war that we see in the third Captain America movie with the formation of the Sokovia Accords, which forced all heroes to work for the government under the rules and regulations. Basically, the MCU took Nitro from the New Warriors, exploding and killing more than 600 people, including school children and the New Warriors, except Speedball, that lit the fire of civil war in the comics and turn that shit up to 11. I really enjoyed Age of Ultron, not as much as the first Avengers film, but I liked the grand scale of it and the character exploration. Plus, I really liked Ultron as a villain, as he basically took what Tony had as a good thought and intent and took it to the darkest place possible. That's something I really like to see in a villain, a colder, more black and white version of the lofty ideals of the hero. Age of Ultron was also fairly well received by critics and grossed over $1.4 billion worldwide. That's $0.1 billion under the first Avengers movie. It became the fourth highest grossing film of 2015 and the fifth highest grossing film of all time, again, at the time when it came out.
Yeah, although I personally love it, I consider Age of Ultron to be something of a flawed gem. I will admit that this movie has its problems. I mean, I did not like the Banner-Natasha romance. And it creates a number of problems within the narrative. There's no chemistry. The relationship feels totally forced. The romance arc even ends up opening up plot holes, such as why Ultron kidnaps Natasha in the first place and why he doesn't kill her when he has no reason to keep her alive. This only happens because the movie needs Banner to come to the rescue, and it doesn't work. I didn't like Quicksilver's death. I thought it was a waste. Also, I don't buy Cap not being worthy of Thor's hammer, while Vision somehow is, but that's a small point. The only reason I really accept Vision lifting the hammer at all is because Vision is an artificial being and probably sidestepped Mjolnir's worthiness clause.
I agree. I agree about Banner and Romanoff. You know, that did feel forced as hell, and I really hated it. It also contradicted what Bruce said, or at least implied, in the first Avengers movie. At the end of The Incredible Hulk, it is suggested that Bruce was gaining some measure of control over the Hulk. And with Banner riding up on his motorcycle, acting like he can change whenever he wants to now because he's always angry, that seemed to imply that there wasn't an issue anymore. But he clearly has less control by the time of Age of Ultron. You're also right about Hawkeye. He is much cooler in the comics than he is in the MCU. It's like they just didn't get him. Also, killing Quicksilver off right away was a big letdown. They tried to make this big dramatic moment out of it too, but it fell flat because he had all of 3 minutes of screen time. As far as Cap and Mjolnir goes, I have to wonder if it was not doubt rather than lack of competence on the part of Cap. He wasn't sure he would be able to lift it, and then when it moved just slightly, he was surprised, as was Thor, who sat up in his seat right away. However, in Avengers Endgame, there is zero doubt or question in Cap's mind. He knows he can summon Mjolnir, and he calls it to him confidently.
You know, I can accept that explanation. I mean, it could be that to be worthy, you need to believe you are. Still, there are a lot more things that I love about Age of Ultron, despite its problems. I mean, I feel like the Age of Ultron did its best to up the ante in terms of its threat, in terms of the emotional scales, in terms of visual effects, and just about every way you could try to elevate a film as a sequel. The battle between Hulk and Iron Man in the Hulkbuster suit is outstanding. The Cap-Tony relationship really ratchets it up, and you get some great lines out of it. Like this one I really love. Quote, "He's in charge. I just pay for everything, design everything, and make everyone look cooler." That's just hilarious. The new additions to the team have their moments, and the Avengers assembling against Ultron is an awesome moment. So I can put aside my problems with the film and still love Age of Ultron for what it is. The movie does a great job of building goodwill and giving you those cool fan-pleaser moments, even when it makes mistakes like that.
That was a great line by Tony. And things definitely step up a notch in the tension between Cap and Tony. All in all, though, I think I agree with your assessment of Age of Ultron. That leaves just two more Avengers films, Infinity War and Endgames, which we'll discuss together for the sake of brevity, as we're going on a bit long here. Avengers Infinity War drew its inspiration from Jim Starlin's 1991 comic book, The Infinity Gauntlet, and Jonathan Hickman's 2013 comic, Infinity, and I think it was done brilliantly. In fact, while I like Infinity War more, that's a tongue twister. Both it and Endgame reset the standard for just how big and epic an Avengers movie can be. I think this was done particularly well by doing a slow burn build-up to it over 11 years, 10 individual franchises, and a solo Hulk film. Doing it this way really made it all so epic, and even with all the characters in it, we knew them and loved them because they had all been so well established before. I think that the MCU phases after 3 have been a step down because they don't have that same grand overarching story with Thanos and the Infinity Stones.
Yeah, I agree that Phase 4 has been a letdown for exactly the reasons you point out. Now, it used to be that the tie-ins were about building a larger epic story between the different films, and they all led to a huge battle with Thanos over the Infinity Gauntlet. We definitely saw that with the setup to Infinity War. And with Phase 4, though, all I see is setting up the multiverse and then introducing the younger legacy characters. And that's really about it. I mean, they need a villain who can tie the things together, which someone like Victor Von Doom would be perfect for. I feel like the MCU has lost sight of what worked for them before, and especially what worked with Infinity War.
You know, Doctor Doom would be a great villain for that, but with the Fantastic Four franchise starting up again, I have to wonder if he's not being saved for that, as Doom is so tied to Richards. Actually, after our discussion here, I'm thinking that Kang the Conqueror might be a good choice. But either way, we're agreed that Phase 4 really needs to put a big bad to tie it all together. But back to Infinity War and Endgame. If I have a complaint about Infinity War and Endgame, it is that they continued the reimagined Thor from Ragnarok. And apparently Chris Hemsworth was a big part of why that went down. At the recommendation of Hemsworth, writers Christopher Marcus, Stephen McFeely consulted Thor Ragnarok director Taika Waititi and screenwriter Eric Pearson to help carry over the comedic and tragic elements of the retoned Thor from that film. I gotta say, it bums me out that even Hemsworth has so little respect for the character, but that everybody else was on board and even took it a step further just irks me, and I fucking hate Fat Thor. But we talked about the differences between the mythological character and the Marvel Comics one in the Thor episode, so I won't go off again, but I just had to vent, sorry.
Well, you're not alone in not being a fan of the big Thor Bowski. There hasn't been much consistency with Thor at all in the MCU, unfortunately. I mean, I hate the way that Professor Hulk was handled too, so I totally get it. I have other issues with Endgame, but it's more to do with the poorly thought time travel stuff. But you know what? We got to see Cap finally be worthy of Mjolnir. And when we finally hear him say Avengers Assemble, it's the perfect moment. Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like Age of Ultron in the sense that the big moments make the little annoyances a bit more palatable.
Oh, dude, Professor Hulk sucked. I mean, walking around giving tacos to people barefoot, what the hell? You're also right on the ball there with the last comment. Those moments were teased and hinted at so many times that it was really satisfying to finally see them. I also agree that moments like those make the worst moments much more forgivable. I really like the way they threw some surprises in there too, particularly as it pertains to the Soul Stone. I was not prepared for Thanos to throw Gamora off that cliff, nor did I expect Natasha to be the one that died between her and Hawkeye. Another moment was when Thanos just straight up whoops Hulk's ass at the beginning of Infinity War. I figured Thanos might win, but Hulk was just outfought in every way. All of those made my mouth drop and my eyes go wide. I also really loved the epic battles with Thanos and, of course, at Wakanda. Those made the theater feel like wide open spaces with its grand scale and wide shots. I also totally felt that moment when Doctor Strange says that the only chance they have to win is if we give them the stone. That scene was dialogue for the most part, and it was still intense. The time travel hijinks and getting to see those events from the previous films from different perspectives was pretty fun, too.
Oh, those are some really shocking and great moments. I mean, when the Russos are on point, you get some really epic Avengers action. As for Doctor Strange, I love that we find out later that he sacrificed his entire future with Christine so that the world could be saved. Multiverse of Madness is a mixed bag as a film, but it made Strange's decision here more poignant and more tragic in retrospect. But in the end, I think that Infinity War and Endgame did their job so well that they left the franchise with not much left to go creatively. If you want to see Endgame as a jumping off point for the MCU, I mean, that's totally reasonable to me. It's very much a clear and defined ending to the entire story that started with phase one.
That bit with Strange's sacrifice really did add a whole lot of weight to what he did, and definitely made it more poignant moment. You also bring up a good point with possibly viewing Infinity War and Endgame and I guess Spider-Man Far From Home as well as a jumping off point for the MCU. You know, the MCU has been around for a while now, and I wonder if there's not a generational thing going on with the obvious split between phases 1 through 3 and phase 4. Phase 4 does seem to be all about the younger and oftentimes legacy heroes for the most part, with the phase 1 through 3 characters now assuming the role of the previous generation's heroes, you know, those who started the legacies.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. I mean, I think they may be trying to start over with new heroes in the vein of phase 1, but really I think a lot of it relates more to business decisions, especially with the old guard not getting any younger. I think Disney may be thinking that they need fresh blood to move the MCU forward, rather than relying on actors who may soon start to age past their roles. Still, I mean, their characters and their stories need to be there, and so far they haven't really proven they can do that consistently with Phase 4.
No, they haven't, and I'm finding that I like less MCU content than I did before when I was taking it all in. Now I find myself picking and choosing among them. But let's talk about how Infinity War and Endgame were received when they came out. The Avengers Infinity War received praise for Brolin's performance, visual effects, action sequences, and emotional weight. The film's visual effects were nominated by the Academy Awards, Critics' Choice Awards, and the British Academy Film Awards. Avengers Endgame received awards from the same people, received numerous awards and nominations as well. And they also got a nomination for special visual effects from the British Academy of Film Awards.
Josh Brolin was excellent as Thanos, so I mean that's praise well earned. He's not the comic Thanos at all, but I felt like Brolin embodied the character very well, and there's no question that the visual effects in that film are outstanding. I mean, they raised their game for it there, no question.
Yeah, they definitely knocked it out of the park with Infinity War, with the Infinity War 2 parter. Very well earned indeed. But that about wraps up our enormous dive into the Avengers. Thanks for hanging out with us as we talked about the Avengers, the Earth's Mightiest Heroes. And we'll see you next time. I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.